The northern arm of the Rocky Mountains is sometimes called the crown of the continent. Among its jewels are glaciers and snowfields that irrigate part of North America during the spring thaw. But the region is getting warmer, even faster than the rest of the world. NPR's Christopher Joyce recently visited scientists in Montana who say warming is scrambling the complex relationship between water and wildlife. It's threatening some with extinction.
I'm flying over northern Montana's mountains in a Cessna two-seater with ecologist Richard Hauer. Snow-capped mountains and wide valleys are spread out below. Hauer calls this place a giant sponge. Moist air from the Pacific hits the mountains and falls as snow and ice. It sits in the mountains until spring, when it melts and runs through the gravel valleys and across big parts of North America. It's worked that way for millennia, but lately, Hauer says, Montana is warmer, and the spring melt starts earlier and flashes through the sponge much faster.
It's changed the case place because the snow melt is occurring earlier, and basically, if you turn the spigot on earlier, it runs out of water sooner.
Running out of water sooner means drier summers, just when plants and animals and people need it most. Ecologists like Hauer, who's at the University of Montana, say there are other changes as well, retreating glaciers and more flash floods. Scientists are studying how all this affects wildlife, wildlife that's important for holding together the whole ecosystem here. I joined three ecologists from the U.S. Geological Survey on a mountainside a couple of thousand feet below Hauer's flight path. We're hiking up into a snowfield in Glacier National Park toward a stream flowing down from the snow.
Great place to be if you're an obscure high alpine stream insect.
Obscure insects are Joe Gersh's life. Several species of rare but important insects live here in 40-degree meltwater. Gersh bends over the stream, it's only a few inches deep, and turns over a few rocks. In 10 minutes, he finds what he wants, a tiny, brown, wet smudge of a fly.
All right, this is Lednia tumana.
Now, come on, you can really tell.
Yeah, I've looked at a lot of these.
I mean, that's smaller than a match head.
Yeah, exactly. It's charismatic microfauna.
Charismatic may be a stretch, but micro for sure. Lednia tumana is a stone fly. It spends part of its life in streams, but only icy streams in these mountains. The fly eats algae and other tiny organisms in the streams, and other insects and birds eat them. They're part of a larger food web. Pull out one string, says ecologist Daniel Fagri, and the web starts to come apart.
In only a few decades, we're going to lose all the glaciers here, and they've been persistent on this landscape for at least 7,000 years. So suddenly you're having a profound change in just a few decades, and that's very difficult for many organisms to adapt to.
What's happening is that as average temperature increases here, the snow and ice retreat up the mountain to colder air. Fagri's colleague Clint Mulfeld says eventually the ice and the insects will run out of mountain.
You know, there's nowhere to go. They're at the top of the continent, the water tower of the continent, and it's squeeze play.
Moving farther down the mountain, you can see more signs of this disruption in the way water works here. In and around Montana's Flathead Lake, for example, one of the biggest lakes in the country. Jack Stanford runs the Flathead Lake Biological Station. He spent decades studying the complex interactions of plants, animals, and water.
The way in which water is deposited first and then transported by the rivers is fundamental to the distribution and abundance of organisms.
Organisms that are important not only to nature, but to people too. Take salmon. Salmon lay eggs in the gravel of stream beds. But if you get a warmer spring, you get flash floods. That's because the rain comes in before the snow has melted. It's called a rain-on-snow event. It's like rain falling on pavement. It creates floods that wash the young salmon away and decimates the population.
The way it plays out is that the food web gets a shake-up. Bottom line is that some players in that complex food web will be winners and some will be losers.
Stanford says humans have already altered the natural world in unpredictable ways. Climate change is like putting another pair of dice in play. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Despite all the efforts to promote healthy eating in recent years, Americans still only eat on average about one serving of fruit each day, and less than half of the recommended amount of vegetables. So as families prepare for back to school and thoughts turn to lunchboxes, some grocery chains are making a new effort to entice families into the produce aisle. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
Think baby carrots. They're everywhere. And if you want to know how they got so popular, you got to talk to Jeff Dunn. He used to be a top executive at Coca-Cola, but several years back, he left and decided to try something new. He and his marketing buddies looked around a typical grocery store produce aisle.
Well, we said it was boring, you know.
And he saw lots of potential to drive up sales of fresh produce and get kids to eat healthy by using the marketing tactics he learned in the soda industry. So he created a Mountain Dew-style ad campaign for baby carrots.
Brought to you by a bunch of carrot farmers.
The ads are full of fast-paced adventure. In this ad, carrots shoot from a cannon. And Dunn says the strategy has worked. His company, Bolt House Farms, has seen sales of fresh carrots, which were flat 4 years ago, start growing.
So we've been able to turn that trend around really through marketing efforts. So it shows that marketing works.
Since then, more and more healthy products aimed at kids have started appearing on the shelves. There are brightly colored all-fruit smoothies with wacky characters on the bottle, squishy tubes of pureed fruit, and yogurt that you can slurp. And now, in order to get to the next level, Dunn has another idea. He wants to give kids their own go-to destination in the grocery store. Their own section, really, filled entirely with products that are healthy and presented in funky ways. He's been working with retailers, including Walmart, and Giant Eagle to reorganize their produce aisles. And his company has been developing new products to help draw kids in.
Those are cool. I like the smoothies. This is awesome.
That's Peter Dykeman Birmingham. He's 18, not really a kid anymore, but he's lasered in on the latest version of baby carrots. It's not just a bag of carrots. Nope, they come with a little pouch of colorful chili lime seasoning that you can shake onto the carrots. They're spicy, crunchy, and have that flavor that sticks to your fingers. Not quite Doritos, but close. Middle schooler Alex Goley gets it.
They kind of taste better than like any other vegetable.
Alex's mom, Rhonda Goley, says bringing junk food tactics to the healthy stuff makes sense.
Absolutely, because I think it's something that just kind of adds a little more fun to eating it.
David Just of Cornell University, who studies what motivates people to eat better, agrees. Despite concerns about marketing to kids, this combination of making healthy products fun and bringing them all together is spot on.
Yes, I think that kid-friendly snacking stations are an absolutely fascinating concept.
It's what the cereal aisles and candy shelves have been doing for decades, but
this is a tactic and a tool that really hasn't been used to promote healthier foods.
Until now. And if it works, Just says kids might be dragging their parents to hit the produce aisle. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Americans are drinking less orange juice than they used to. OJ sales last year hit the lowest level in more than a decade. There are many reasons for this. Orange juice production is down, prices are up, and competition from other drinks is increasing. All of this has left Florida orange growers wondering about their industry's future. NPR's Greg Allen reports from Miami.
The year was 1969.
What? Ooh. Orange juice with natural vitamin C from the Florida sunshine tree.
In TV commercials, spokesperson Anita Bryant reminded Americans that breakfast without orange juice is like a day without sunshine. Today, nearly all of Florida's oranges are still squeezed for juice, but there are many fewer oranges. Last season, Florida produced just over 100 million boxes, less than half the amount produced 10 years ago. The main reason is citrus greening, a disease that's affected nearly every orange grove in Florida. In Claremont, Florida, Matt McLean points out how greening is affecting his orange trees.
Small fruit, not sizing, a little misshapen. You'll see the green.
So you can tell just because from the size right away?
Yeah, most of the time you can tell that it's too small and it's not sizing. A lot of it's still green while the rest of it's color broke.
McLean grows oranges without pesticides for his Uncle Matt's organic orange juice brand. He uses organic nutrients, compost, and botanical oils to help control the disease. But he says greening is taking a toll.
For the first time in our 15-year history, we've had to import product outside of Florida.
With not enough available in Florida, Uncle Matt's is now also using organic oranges grown in Mexico and California. As production has declined, the price of orange juice has gone up, taking it off many breakfast tables. For many, orange juice is becoming more of an optional luxury drink.
Today, that's just a fact.
Marty McKenna is an orange grower and chairman of the Florida Citrus Commission. McKenna says citrus greening is just part of the problem. Orange juice is still far and away America's best-selling juice. But today, consumers have many other juice and beverage options. McKenna says rising orange juice prices have provided competitors with an opening.
We do have a loss of shelf space, and, you know, a grocery store is going to fill that shelf space with something. So competition is much, much keener now than what it ever has been.
The industry, along with the state and federal governments, are spending millions of dollars on research looking for an answer to citrus greening. In the meantime, Florida growers are grappling with another industry problem, charges by some researchers that because of the amount of fructose they contain, orange and other fruit juices can promote childhood obesity. Barry Popkin, a professor of nutrition at the University of North Carolina, says numerous studies have looked at the health impact of fructose and fruit juice. The results, he says, are convincing.
Every study that followed people for more than a day for years has shown an adverse effect on cardiovascular health from fruit juice that's equal or more powerful than that of soft drinks.
Many doctors now recommend limiting the amount of fruit juice children consume each day. The citrus industry cites its own studies, which it says show for children that orange juice can be part of a healthy diet. To get that message out, Florida's Department of Citrus is working on a new public relations campaign. Public Relations Director David Steele says the industry group is working with Marvel Comics to update its Captain Citrus character.
We will be bringing out not only a live-action figure, but also a printed comic book and a couple of digital-only comic books. The comics will feature Captain Citrus along with the Avengers, which is, of course, one of Marvel's famous properties.
Along with battling evildoers, there will be a message, of course, about how orange juice can be part of every superhero's healthy diet. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
We're going to spend a little time now in a cemetery in the interest of science. Veronique LaCapra of St. Louis Public Radio mustered up her courage and went out to the cemetery at night.
I'd visited St. Louis's Bell Fountain Cemetery before, but never at night.
It is dark. There's just about a half a moon visible in the sky. And, wait a minute, what's that over there?
I can see eerie lights and strange, shadowy figures moving among the gravestones.
Look, there comes one of them now.
Hi, my name is Vana Kuczynska, and I'm a wildlife biologist, and I'm a student at the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
Okay, those mysterious lights, headlamps, and the ghosts or zombies? Just researchers. They're part of an effort to try to get an idea of the range of wildlife that's in the cemetery. Scientists have already studied birds here. Tonight, some people are looking at moths. Kuczynska is focusing on bats.
When you're holding a bat in your hand, you just see how beautiful they are, and they have so much personality.
What do you mean? Wait. So bats have personalities?
Bats absolutely have personalities.
Some species, she tells me, are really gentle and don't seem to mind being handled.
Whereas other bats, usually the bigger bats, are way more aggressive and they'll try to bite you and escape and do all these things.
Kaczynska's in the cemetery trying to find out what kinds of bats are flying around here. That's a big brown bat, complaining about getting snagged in one of the nets Kuczynska and her helpers set up before sunset. They look something like oversized volleyball nets, only with much finer mesh. But very few bats actually get caught in them. That's because bats use a kind of biological sonar called echolocation to avoid obstacles and find their insect prey, even in the dark. So Kuczynska is also using a special bat detector. To show me how it works, she carries the big brown bat toward a small device that's lying on the ground. It's about the size and shape of a paperback book. It's called an anabat.
So the bat is making a lot of noises that we can't hear. They're not in the audible range. And so the anabat is recording these noises and playing them back to us in a range that we can hear. And it allows us to see if there's activity, bat activity in the area.
Now, it turns out that cemeteries aren't just great places for spooky things like bats.
I mean, I suspect that most of the species that are found in cities are probably also using cemeteries.
Seth Magley, who directs the Urban Wildlife Institute in Chicago, says with increasing urbanization, it's critical that animals have places in cities where they can live. He says like parks, golf courses, and other urban green spaces, cemeteries can also provide an essential refuge for all sorts of wildlife.
Coyotes, red foxes, skunks, woodchucks, opossum, white-tailed deer, beaver.
Along with more common city residents, like birds and squirrels. It's easy to see why animals would be drawn to a cemetery like Bell Fountain. It's more of a majestic 19th century park with thousands of big trees spread out over more than 300 acres. But Magley says some animals can forage even in a place that's just gravestones and grass.
Species like coyotes are not terribly selective about that kind of stuff. It seems like mostly what they're looking for in these urban areas are rabbits, and rabbits like grass. So the rabbits will come in for the grass, and then the coyotes may come in for the rabbits.
The idea of cemeteries as wildlife habitat may seem kind of strange here in America, where most cemeteries are kept pretty manicured. But over in England, where, like in the U.S., urban development and industrial agriculture have reduced wildlife habitat, it's common practice to let at least the older parts of cemeteries go back to a more natural state.
Nobody wants to go to an overgrown grave for a loved one, but we can have little messy places here and there.
Mandy Elford works as an ecologist for the city of Manchester, which is actively trying to make its cemeteries more wildlife-friendly. How do you think the dead would feel about having all this wildlife running around their graves?
I don't think they'll mind one little bit.
Personally, Elford says, she'd be very happy about it. For NPR News, I'm Veronique LaCapra.
Let's talk about something basic now, your clothes and what they're made of. The demand for cotton is on the rise around the world, but cotton producers are having a hard time keeping up with demand. They've been hurt by increases in extreme weather and drought, and that creates challenges for clothing makers, some of whom are looking to alternatives, as NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
VF Corporation is one of the biggest clothing companies you've never heard of. But its brands include Lee and Wrangler jeans, Timberland shoes, and the North Face. It also makes uniforms for police and major league sports teams.
So VF is a large purchaser of cotton. We buy roughly 1% of the cotton available in the world.
Letitia Webster is VF's Senior Director of Sustainability, whose job it is to both reduce the company's greenhouse gas footprint and reduce its risks from climate change.
Some of the biggest impacts actually come from cotton.
Cotton grows commercially in most countries around the world and is very resource-intensive to cultivate and process. On the one hand, agronomists say it's relatively hardy because it grows in hot climates. But its Achilles heel is water. It needs it for growing and processing, but too much water can also kill it. Several years ago, bad weather events in China and Pakistan hit Webster's company's cotton supply and its bottom line.
So we actually do want to diversify. We want to make sure that we are insulated from some of that.
VF is training 400 Chinese farmers to switch to new kinds of cotton plants that use less water. And Webster says VF's labs are also developing futuristic alternatives. Fibers grown from bacteria, for example, and adhesive fabrics that can repair themselves to improve a garment's longevity.
I think in the aggregate, it is all about actually reducing risk, which actually does cost.
One thing the company is doing today is increasing its use of recycled polyester fibers developed by a company called Unify. Unify is a polyester yarn maker that operates just 50 miles from VF's corporate headquarters in Greensboro, North Carolina. Unify rode the 1970s boom in polyester, but like many textile makers, lost business in the 1990s to cheaper international competition. Roger Barrier is president and chief operating officer for Unify.
We've downsized to about 50% of what we were, but we were still losing money. So we really had to rethink our strategy, and what we decided to do is look to innovation.
7 years ago, Unify sought to save itself some money by turning plastic waste, bottles and leftover polyester scraps, into yarn.
Flakes here. So it starts from a bottle, and the bottle is
washed and then chopped up into these flakes.
At the Unify plant, these plastic flakes travel noisily through metal pipes. Machines melt, extrude, and spin them into a textured string the company calls REPREVE that closely resembles yarn. REPREVE costs a premium to produce, so for almost a year after development, it sat on the shelves without a buyer. Then things changed. Consumer interest in recycled goods picked up, cotton prices spiked, and companies like VF went looking for alternatives. Now, REPREVE is used in performance athletic gear, fleece jackets, and backpacks. Demand is growing 20% a year. The Unify plant has already expanded, and Barrier says to secure a supply of used plastic, Unify now funds campaigns promoting recycling.
Our goal is to increase the recycling rate, so we have plenty of material available, which should reduce the cost.
And cost is a key issue. A fleece jacket made with REPREVE uses no cotton, a lot less water, and produces two-thirds less greenhouse gas than one made from unrecycled fabric, but it's also more expensive. Back at VF's headquarters, Letitia Webster says that, for now, the company is eating that extra cost.
We can't charge more for the products right now. It has to be just baked in.
It's all part of a costly upfront investment the company is making in order to attract customers to the new alternatives. Over time, Webster says, the company hopes to bring its massive scale to bear and incorporate cotton substitutes into more products. She says that will both reduce the cost of the newer materials and shield VF from climate change risks. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
A century ago, miners working in California's Death Valley reported seeing big rocks in the desert floor with long trails behind them as if they'd been pushed by some unseen force. Every once in a while, the rocks have moved again, but no one has ever seen it happen. Now, after 60-plus years of trying, scientists think they have solved the mystery of the slithering rocks of Death Valley. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
For decades, scientists have been trekking out to a dry lake bed called the Racetrack in Death Valley to see these rocks for themselves. Many are boulders weighing 500 pounds, and leading up to many of them are those erratic trails in the sand.
They do things like they take high-angle turns, sometimes they reverse course.
Geologist Richard Norris at Scripps Institution of Oceanography was very puzzled when he first saw them.
They are just going, you know, every which way out there, but in a very regular kind of fashion, like they're moving in fleets.
Fleets of slithering boulders. Norris joined a community of scientists who had been obsessed with trying to find out what was going on here. There were several theories. One long-standing one was windstorms. Once, in 1953, a researcher landed a plane on the lake bed and tried moving the rocks with the wind off his propellers. The rocks didn't slide, though a few did roll. Some people thought maybe ice was forming underneath the rocks on cold nights and they were ice skating. But no one actually saw that happening. So Norris got together with his cousin, who's an engineer. They said, okay, what if we put GPS trackers on those rocks and video cameras around them to catch the rocks in the act?
And no one ever said to you, Richard, you're nuts.
Oh, well, kind of. I think that a lot of people thought, you know, why are you putting GPS trackers on rocks?
They set everything up and just waited. Then, early one morning in December, rain had fallen the night before. A thin sheet of ice had formed over the lake bed, or playa as it's called. There was a light breeze. And then the sun came up, and the answer to the mystery unfolded.
The ice began to melt out in the center of the playa, and the ice began to pop and crackle all across the playa surface as the ice began to move.
Thin sheets of ice, dozens of them, 40 or 50 feet across. The wind was pushing each sheet over a film of water and watery sand, shoving them up against the rocks.
It's basically being like a tugboat or a bulldozer. It's pushing the rocks very slowly along.
But by the end of the day, some of the rocks had moved hundreds of feet. The ice and water had evaporated, and in the now dry sand, furrowed trails marked each rock's journey. Norris thinks the conditions for this to happen occur very rarely, once in decades perhaps, and they had been very lucky to catch it. One of the first people they told about the discovery was Paula Messina at San Jose State University. She'd written her PhD thesis on the sliding rocks, and like many scientists, she believed that freak windstorms were moving those rocks.
And even though they were showing me data and photographs, I still couldn't believe it.
I went down to the racetrack and had to observe it for myself because I thought, no, it can't possibly be.
But now, she says, she and scientists who believed the wind hypothesis are now laughing about how wrong they were, and Norris is laughing with them.
It's so much fun. Pretty much everybody was out there because it was a neat problem and it was fun to do. And I think there's no purer form of science than that.
Norris's team has published the findings in the journal PLOS One. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.